101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here are your hosts, Katie Comley and Rita Farkas.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, we take a look at a perspective on the Taser story.
And Vancouver Island has some new environmental initiatives up its sleeve.
And on commentary this week, Phil Caudry weighs in on the Canadian Supreme Court decision to deny political refuge to two U.S. Army officers opposed to the Iraq War.
We'll have all this, plus arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next hour right here on News 101.
This week, Radio Free UBC presents an interview with Roger Annis from Nate Cromwell.
I'm here with Roger Annis. Roger Annis is a local labor union activist in Vancouver and a coordinator with Canada-Haiti Action Network. Roger, you were recently in Haiti?
Yes, that's right. I was there for 2 weeks in August, from August 5th to the 20th. I took part in a human rights investigative delegation that was organized by two Haitian Americans, and there were seven of us altogether. We had a very extensive visit in the country. We spent a week in the north of Haiti, in the different towns and villages in the north, and then a week in the capital city, Port-au-Prince. We had a very ambitious program of meetings, interviews, observations. So we got a pretty thorough look country and talked to a lot of the leading political figures in the country, whether it was representatives from the foreign embassies or of the Haitian government, and then most importantly of the popular organizations of the Haitian people.
So what did you guys find? What were your overall sort of impressions of Haiti?
Well, it was very disturbing. Overall, the country is living through what we would conclude and what Haitians themselves told us, a social and economic calamity. It's been 3.5 years since Haiti's elected government was overthrown by a foreign intervention that included 500 Canadian soldiers. This intervention was done in the name of bringing democracy and progress to the Haitian people, but it's done the opposite. It subverted and destroyed the democratic institutions of the Haitian people, and it's caused an unprecedented economic and social catastrophe in the country.
So the Canadian mission, though, is often sort of touted as this kind of, the United Nations mission is touted as this sort of humanitarian kind of success. But it seems like that might not be the case. Could you sort of say a bit about the UN mission itself?
Sure, yeah, I could say it's definitely not the case. The UN has a very preponderant presence in Haiti right now. The UN endorsed and sponsored the intervention of February 29th, 2004, that removed Haiti's elected president and presence in Haiti. They spend about $600 million per year. And what they're overseeing is a rapidly declining economic and social situation in the country. Unemployment in Haiti runs at 70 or 80%. There's no foreign investment of any substance coming into the country. The government of Haiti, which as of February 2006 is a government elected in a flawed electoral process, but nonetheless one that has some legitimacy in the eyes of the Haitian people, has very little money and resources to commit to the social and economic policies and programs of the country. Half of Haiti's children don't go to school. People do not have access to clean drinking water. Haiti is still a largely agricultural country, but its capacity to produce food has been sharply undermined by the policies of Canada, the United States, and Europe in foisting subsidized food production from the wealthy countries of the world onto Haiti and therefore undermining the capacity of Haitian peasants to grow food. So, you know, that's just a thumbnail sketch. It's a country of 8.5 million people, and it's, you know, truly calamitous, the conditions that we saw.
The delegation that you were on, you guys had a chance to look at sort of the prison system and the situation with the up to 800 or more political prisoners who have been captured and held since the coup of 2004. Could you say some things about the prison system?
Haiti's prison population today numbers 6,200. That's double the number of prisoners that were being held at the time of the intervention of 2004 and the overthrow of the elected government. They're being held in truly deplorable conditions of overcrowding and lack of health care and sanitation and adequate exercise, food, you name it. We were pretty horrified by the conditions that we saw. Among the 6,200 prisoners are several hundred political prisoners that date from the time of the two-year imposed, what they called interim government, that followed the intervention of February 2004. According to a recent study of the conditions in the prisons, fully 83% of those who are behind bars in Haiti have not been convicted of a crime. They're in there because of the tremendous delays in processing people, as well as the abuses by the Haitian National Police in arbitrarily arresting people and placing them in prison. Once you go into the prison, it's very difficult to get out. Now, this should all be of great concern to Canadians because there are two things that the Canadian government prides itself on for its role in the past 3.5 years in Haiti. One is the funding and financing of Haiti's justice system, the prisons, the courts, the trial procedures, and so forth. And what we saw throughout Haiti was a totally glaring absence of resources in order to treat the cases that come into conflict with the law. That's why so many people sit in prison without having seen judges and having had trials. Canada also contributes to the Haitian National Police. It's been the training force of the Haitian National Police since the coup of 2004, and the Haitian National Police was and remains a human rights violating agency that's responsible for hundreds and several thousands of deaths following the overthrow of the elected government, and a police institution which today is largely outside of the control of Haiti's constitution and of the government and judicial officials that are responsible for the application of Haiti's constitution. So one has to ask the question what the money and resources that Canada has put into training this police force has led to. By all evidence, it's helped to reinforce and bolster an agency that is has been a grave violator of human rights in Haiti.
So in other words, Canada is propping up two of the most unpopular institutions in the country right now, the police and the judicial system.
Very much. The two biggest complaints that we heard from Haitian people, and there are many complaints to be had, but one is the absence of jobs and of any meaningful plan for economic development in the country, and the other is the continued abuses in the by the police and in the justice system that Haitians encounter. There is no progress on any of these that's being marked by the foreign presence now, which dates from three and a half years, and certainly the image that the Canadian government likes to present. When it talks about Haiti, and we must say they don't talk very often about Haiti, unfortunately. They're not compelled to by the political and media setup in Canada, but they like to pretend that there's some kind of progress being made towards a better society for the Haitian people. And we did not see that. What we heard from Haitians is that they were making progress in developing their society prior to February 2004, but the elected government that they had in place and the elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who they had in place to do that, were making progress along these lines, and this was all cut short by the foreign intervention.
Today, what is the solidarity movement here in Vancouver and in Canada? What are you planning, and what do you think you can do to advance the situation and the condition of people in Haiti?
Well, we've been active pretty much since the events of 2004 in trying to make the Canadian public aware of the grave social, economic, and human rights conditions in Haiti. We came together as the Canada-Haiti Action Network in early 2005, so we have a network of committees in more than a dozen cities across Canada. Our primary focus remains one of education and also of pressuring the Canadian and other foreign powers that are in Haiti to withdraw their what we call their occupation forces. Haiti has a right to its sovereignty. The Haitian people are more than able to have a sovereign government and have that government act on programs that represent the interests of the Haitian majority. The biggest obstacle to social and economic development today in Haiti is the fact that the country's sovereignty has been taken from them, that the sovereign institutions of the country are not respected and are not accorded the resources necessary to organize society. We want a fundamental change in where the money from the foreign powers and the United Nations itself is going in Haiti. There's a very desperate need for road building, for improvements in healthcare and education, for investments in economic activity, and this is where foreign countries and powers should be putting resources. The one bright spot in that regard that exists today in Haiti is the substantial aid, both in economic terms and also in for social development, that's coming to Haiti from Venezuela and Cuba. And so we ask the question, why is it that the wealthiest countries in the world are not able to provide the kind of outstanding solidarity that Venezuela and Cuba have been providing to Haiti? And that's what we want. That's the change in policy that we want to see.
Well, thank you, Roger. Thanks for talking to us today.
Well, you're very welcome, and thanks for your interest.
And thanks to Radio Free UBC for that piece. Now with a look at other local news, here are News 101 reporters Tracy Fuller and Hannah Kim.
The cancellation of the annual Christmas herring sale for the CKNW Orphans Fund will not go ahead as scheduled due to bureaucratic red tape. A decision out of Ottawa has hampered CKNW's fundraising efforts, perhaps permanently, as a new decision out of a New Brunswick court has prohibited taking fish out of the ocean for charitable purposes. Shirley Stalker, organizer of the herring sale, says that Ottawa turned down their request for a fishing permit to let the sale continue. Stalker also says that further meetings will be held with the Department of Fisheries to see if there is any way for the sale to continue. Each year, the Orphan Fund raises thousands of dollars for underprivileged children in BC during the holiday season.
If you plan to be in the downtown area this weekend, be advised that Canada Line construction will close down the intersection of 16th Avenue and Canby Street from tonight at 8 p.m. till Sunday night at 11 p.m. Northbound and southbound traffic on Canby near 16th will also be reduced to single lane, alternating during this time.
The Hollywood writers' strike is beginning to take a visible toll on the Vancouver film industry. Production on locally shot shows such as The Bionic Woman and Battlestar Galactica have already stopped production and will continue, with Smallville being the last to stop filming new episodes at the end of January. Each show filmed here in Vancouver employs about 100 to 200 Canadian workers, all of whom will be out of a job till the strike ends, and even then the future looks uncertain. Prior to the strike, the rising Canadian dollar had deterred many productions from filming north of the border. But now, even with industry initiatives planning to take the American dollar at par when filming recommences, union leader Don Ramstead of IATSE Local 669 says Vancouver is not going to be high on the list of places for productions to settle on.
Moving on to local and slightly provincial news, with the recent release of a home video to the media and internet, the death of Polish immigrant Robert Jasanski and the conduct of the RCMP are garnering worldwide attention and have become the subject of fierce debate among civilians, government officials, and law enforcement internationally. Jasanski, and I apologize if I am mispronouncing the name, was a 40-year-old Polish national who was in the process of immigrating to Canada and had arrived at YVR on October 14th. The recently released video shows Jasanski being tasered twice in an attempt by police to subdue the clearly distressed man, who had earlier thrown a computer and a chair at the window of the International Arrivals Lounge, where he had been waiting for his mother for a previous 8 hours. Jasanski died shortly thereafter. There are still many questions that have been left unanswered regarding the October 14th incident. Four separate investigations have been launched to look at the event, one each by the BC Coroner, the RCMP, the Public Complaints Commissioner for the RCMP, and the Vancouver Airport Authority. Even officials at the Polish Foreign Ministry are weighing in on the controversial incident. Ministry spokesperson Robert Szymanski has stated that the four RCMP officers involved in the incident should be prosecuted for their excessively brutal and unjustified conduct. Szymanski's comment come on the heels of an invitation of the Polish ambassador Piotr Ogorzinski to Canada to meet with his Canadian equivalent in Warsaw to discuss the incident.
Victoria councillors have approved a preliminary bylaw regarding pesticide use this week. The potential pesticide use reduction bylaw will require residents to obtain permits for pesticide use is passed. Under the proposal, the City of Victoria as well as businesses will be exempt from the bylaw, but the residents will be subject to the $25 permit requirement. The approval follows some criticisms by various organizations, including Nancy Falconers of the Canadian Cancer Society, who says the draft has some limitations, particularly in its definition of non-essential use of pesticides, as well as the permitting procedures. Conversely, the Canadian Federation of Independent Business wrote a letter asking the council to focus on a public awareness campaign, teaching residents about the responsible use of pesticides rather than implementing restrictions on use. The proposed bylaw must next be ratified at a council meeting. If it is approved, the bylaw is set to become effective on January 1st, 2009. This will follow an educational campaign aimed to teach residents about proper alternatives to pesticide use. Councillor Pam Medoff said the city's bylaw is imperfect, but it is a first step.
Still with environmental efforts on Vancouver Island, a superstore in Langford is working towards eliminating plastic bags at the store. They will no longer be selling the plastic bags at the checkout and are hoping it will encourage customers to use more, to bring more of their own reusable bags. In addition, the store will begin selling reusable shopping bags made of recycled plastic water bottles. The material is said to look and feel like cloth, making it a good candidate for reusable bags. This is the second store of the chain to introduce the bag elimination as part of its commitment to reducing waste. Lori Steen, a spokeswoman for Loblaws Companies, says it's the store's goal to keep a billion single-use plastic bags out of the landfill. She adds that at least a million bags from the one real Canadian superstore alone end up in landfills each year. So far, customers of the store seem quite impressed with the initiative, says Steen. In April this year, Leaf Rapids in Manitoba became the first municipality in Canada to ban single-use plastic bags. Retailers now face a fine of up to $1,000 if they hand out plastic bags.
Okay, we're now going to take another break, but when we come back, we'll update you on national and international news. Stay with us. News 101 will continue right after this.
Boy, I'm glad we paid our electric bill.
Electricity is our servant in many ways.
Uh-oh, here we go again.
Oh, Terry, I'm interested. Where does electricity come from, Jasper?
I'm sorry I mentioned it.
Well, electricity can come from many places, from many different sources of power, like hydroelectric power.
Hydroelectric?
Hydro means water. Water power to make electricity.
Want to learn more? Join Team PowerSmart. Visit bchydro.com/teampowersmart to make a difference and conserve today. Influence the future of energy conservation in BC by entering BC Hydro's Innovation Challenge, open exclusively to participating post-secondary institutions in BC. You could win one of three cash prizes. Visit bchydro.com/innovationchallenge before November 30th to find out more.
That you can join for free, and kids in every neighborhood belong. It's the Bunny Company, cause it's just for fun, you see. So come on running when you hear our song.
All you people care about is readers and making money off of her. She's a human! Leave Brittany alone!
If you don't want to miss your favorite CITR show because it makes fun of the spiel, then you've got nothing to worry about. Now you can get all of the CITR 101.9 FM radio shows off our website and download them straight onto your computer or MP3 players. Just visit www.citr.ca/podcast and dive into a pool of all of the past radio shows, such as...
Because all you people want is more, 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 more! Leave her alone!
All to your little heart's desire.
5:20, and the news continues on CITR. In medical news, researchers say that the blood shed during women's menstrual cycles may provide a new type of stem cell that could develop into many types of human cells. Recent researchers have indicated that the uterine lining is indeed a rich source of adult stem cells, but that there have been questions about how to harvest those cells. Xialong Meng of the Biocommunications Research Institute, a private research institute in Wichita, Kansas, has led a team who studied cells taken from the menstrual blood of two women, and the team claims to have found cells that behaved very much like stem cells. The team found that the cells doubled about every 19.4 hours, proliferating more rapidly than the stem cells harvested from umbilical cords. And the researchers were also able to develop menstrual blood cells into at least 9 different types of cells, including heart, liver, and lung cells. The researchers conclude that the cells could be cultured at a large scale and hold many potential uses. Meng has commented on the difficulties in current methods of stem cell therapy, like those taken from bone marrow, and how the new discovery presents a possible new way to overcome this impediment. A U.S.-based company has already launched a service to allow women to collect and cryopreserve their menstrual blood.
In international news, a judge has ruled that Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf, that his plans to stay in power may be cut short. FSRN's Devin Theriot Orr reports.
Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf's appointment of a caretaker government late last night has drawn immediate criticism from leaders of the opposition. They claim that free and fair elections are impossible under martial law because political parties are not permitted to organize, and over half of Pakistan's higher judiciary has been fired. Musharraf's efforts to stay in power for another term hit yet another snag today, as 3 of his hand-picked Supreme Court judges have recused themselves from hearing legal challenges to the imposition of martial law. From Pakistan, Devin Theriot Orr reports.
Musharraf's choice for prime minister is Mohammad Mian Somro, who was the chair of the Senate and is currently the leader of Musharraf's faction of the Pakistan Muslim League, the PMLQ. Hassan, a lecturer from Punjab University who asked that he be identified under a pseudonym because of his political activities, challenged the legitimacy of the caretaker government.
Given that there are thousands of lawyers in jail, given that, you know, political leadership of the political opposition, political parties are in jail, anything that Musharraf does or anyone that he appoints automatically gets discredited. So caretaker government, fine, but again, the caretaker government is still under Musharraf. No one will accept anything that has Musharraf's backing.
Deep Saeeda, a pro-democracy activist, expressed doubt about whether the caretaker government would be able to hold fair elections without a free judiciary.
In this kind of martial law and emergency, this is a joke to announce a caretaker government. The prime minister, he announced he's a leader of his own political party, Pakistan Muslim League Q group. And how you can, when there is no courts, how you can expect that we will have a fair election?
Musharraf continues to state that elections will be held under martial law, even though public meetings are banned and many political workers are jailed. Attorney and Pakistan People's Party spokesman Khurram Latif Khosa rejects Musharraf's plans.
We are thinking of boycotting the elections. We will not accept any elections under the rule of emergency.
On the eve of American envoy John Negroponte's arrival, Musharraf is making concessions to deflect international criticism. In an indication that he may be finally preparing to relinquish his uniform, Musharraf amended the provisional constitutional order to allow a civilian president to make future amendments. Khosa comments.
The chief of army staff, mind you, is General Pervez Musharraf. And the so-called president is also General Pervez Musharraf. Now he says that he himself is delegating the power to himself to lift the emergency whenever he feels like. It's a joke.
Musharraf has also unblocked access to most international and domestic television channels and has released Benazir Bhutto and human rights activist Asma Jahangir from house arrest. Bhutto has promised to call an all-parties opposition conference after reconciling with her former rival, exiled PM Nawaz Sharif. But many Pakistanis, such as Deep, remain critical of Bhutto's actions.
Now she's compromised with this dictator just to save herself from the corruption charges. This is ridiculous, and United States should realize that people are not so stupid in this country. People are aware of the situation and they're all the deals and hidden agendas.
But the fight against dictatorship will not end with Musharraf, according to Hassan.
For the people of Pakistan, the fight is about dictatorship and democracy. And when we say dictatorship, it is not just Musharraf. We're talking about military dictatorship. We're talking about an institution which has more or less hijacked the country. So the fight is against them. And they have basically used the whole extremist discourse to present to the West that the fight is about extremism and enlightened, so-called enlightened moderation.
Despite Musharraf's efforts to restore order, protests have continued around the country. 3,000 students protested at Punjab University today, and there are plans for an all-student conference next week. In Karachi last night, 5 PPP members, including 2 children, were killed by police, while hundreds were arrested. With more protests planned and international pressure mounting, Musharraf has a rough road ahead. For FSRN, this is Devon Terrio, Orr in Lahore.
And thanks, as always, to Free Speech Radio News for making that piece available for Read Broadcast. It's now time for another break here on News 101, but stay tuned for commentary and much, much more coming up on the other side.
Want to know what's going on around town? LiveMusicVancouver.com is the Lower Mainland's comprehensive source for live music listings. We've got more than 350 shows listed at any time, and our listings are updated continuously by hundreds of the very people who put on the shows you love. Artist information and MP3s are accessible right from the listings, as are maps and calendars for virtually every venue in the city. All this and tons more totally free at LiveMusicVancouver.com.
Wonder what happened to all those Broadway musical characters that ended up alone?
Yes, tell me.
They came together in a brand new performance. In this show, written and directed by Megan Crosby, characters including Amos Hart from Chicago and the Phantom from Phantom of the Opera join in unexpected ways.
I heard there's going to be amazing singing, acting, and dancing for a show you won't want to miss.
The show is called That's Another Story, and it's playing Friday, November 23rd and Saturday, November 24th at the Scarf Building at UBC. For more information or to purchase tickets, please email gs_tickets@yahoo.ca or visit the website at www.gsubc.ca.
It's going to be the world premiere of the original cast.
Welcome back to News 101. It's time for commentary, and this week, Phil Caudry is taking a look at the Canadian Supreme Court decision to deny political refuge to 2 U.S. Army officers opposed to the Iraq War.
Canada's Supreme Court ruled on Thursday that 2 U.S. Army deserters who sought refuge in Canada on grounds of their opposition to the war in Iraq have lost their case. The ruling delivers a major blow to the Americans who have fled to Canada rather than fight in a war they claim is immoral and unfounded. Their lawyer, Jeffrey House, is representing 40 other U.S. military deserters and believes that there are as many as 300 other U.S. war resistors hiding in Canada. The argument of Jeremy Hinsman, one of the 2 war resistors Jeffrey House is defending, claims he would have been persecuted if forced to return to the United States. Furthermore, House argued that there would be a strong chance of his clients being arrested if they went back to their country of origin. However, the Supreme Court saw it otherwise and ruled that they would not be at risk of cruel and unusual treatment or punishment. The Supreme Court decision effectively renders the war resistors' stay in Canada illegal, forcing them to return to the United States. If the Supreme Court granted them political asylum, they would have been the first 2 American military officers to have been given this treatment in Canadian history. A new precedent would have been set, which would have obliged the Canadian government to grant asylum for more Americans that resisted the Iraq War and future wars. Today we'll discuss both the good and the bad that could come from this decision. Canada has had a history of accepting American draft dodgers during the Vietnam War. 30 to 50,000 Americans fled to Canada during that time and were allowed to settle here. The difference being that the Americans during the Vietnam War were ordinary citizens who were drafted to fight. The ones seeking refuge today voluntarily enlisted in the military before the Iraq War began. So there is a fundamental difference between the situations. In the case of the Vietnam War, Canada accepting draft dodgers sent the message to the U.S. that it did not believe in the draft for that war. If Canada accepts political refugees, the message will be that it opposes the U.S.'s war in Iraq. While Canada is not involved in the Iraq War, if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the U.S. soldiers, this action would embolden Canada's opposition to the U.S. foreign policy. With already frosty relations between the countries, pragmatically this would not be an astute move. Additionally, it could be perceived as not respecting the will of a democratic neighbor. One could argue that if a person voluntarily chooses to enlist in the military, they should be aware of the risk of having to participate in a military conflict they personally oppose. However, if it is made clear by the Supreme Court that this ruling is under exceptional circumstances due to the nature of the particular war, granting political refugee status may make sense. The war in Iraq has been plagued by George Bush's administration's lies and deception. The war began under false pretenses that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and that immediate action was necessary. Such a foreign policy blunder will inevitably lead to military personnel wanting to disassociate with such a war and seeking refuge. Unfortunately, it's not cut and dry, and with every war, a case can be made that it is unethical and unfounded. With Canada's legal system based on precedent, this legally could be a slippery slope. The courts erred on the side of caution with their decision. While probably the wrong decision in this particular case, it was the right one to make to prevent future Canadian-American relations being at peril during inevitable future conflicts. For News 101 Commentary, I'm Phil Cottery.
And thanks, as always, for that, Phil. We're now going to go to our foreign correspondent, Peter Otis, with a look at something happening in Copenhagen.
You could be forgiven for thinking that you've just stumbled into some seedy part of Copenhagen here. To my right, as far as the eye can see, there's a long string of graffiti, long wall of graffiti, most of it anti-establishment, anti-police. Yet we're only 5 minutes away from the center of Copenhagen, in a part of town called Christianshavn. Now behind those walls of graffiti, I see some buildings, old brick buildings, also with graffiti on them, not in the best state. But the place I was visiting on that frosty Sunday afternoon was no shanty town. No, what I was describing is actually not even part of Denmark or the EU. I took a walk around Freetown, Christiania, an autonomous territory just across the bridge from the city center. But while I take you on this walk with me, let me fill you in on a few details about this place. Christiania was born in 1971. A diverse group of residents, upset by the lack of affordable housing, caught word that the military was moving out of its old barracks. The next day, as soon as the military moved out, squatters moved in and took over the area. The community grew in the spirit of communism and the hippie movement. The settlers held idealistic visions of building up society from scratch, free of all the restraints of the real world. The mission of the community was built over time and eventually grew into a fully fledged society with its own newspaper, currency, government, and judicial system. Very quickly, Christiania turned into a mecca of sorts for creative minds and societal outcasts. But this ultra-liberal area also drew in some of the darker parts of society. One of the key rules on which Christiania was built is that only soft drugs could be sold. But by the 1980s, drug gangs from Copenhagen had taken over the streets, monopolizing the drug market and threatening local residents. Then, in 2004, when the government stepped in to put an end to open drug trafficking, more turmoil followed. Criminal gangs from northwest Copenhagen, that's where I live, seized control of the market, and eventually one Christiania resident was murdered in a feud. One can easily say that Christianites have had an uneasy relationship with Danish authorities. So what does the Freetown look like now? On a frosty November afternoon, it was considerably quieter than when I visited in September. Winding through the side streets, I had to walk for quite a while before I stumbled upon somebody else, a man waving his hands around and mumbling to himself. Then I got to the main street, aptly named Pusher Street, and things livened up. On my left, coffee shops, bakeries, and a small market with large Jamaican flags and pictures of Bob Marley. To my right, a group of four or five men in their early 50s, beers in hand, sitting on a wooden bench, arguing. The biggest difference that hits me right away is the number of people on the street just standing around idly. It's very reminiscent of what I've seen in the developing world. In Vancouver and Copenhagen, it seems, if you're on the street, you're in a hurry with places to be and people to see. People seem to move in a lower gear when they're in Christiania. I also cannot help but notice the unique demographics of those standing around me. Most of the people who I assume to be residents are baby boomers. Their appearance hints at a tale of a nostalgic hippie, unwilling to let the spirit of 1969 wither away. The only young people I see sit in cafes, feeling oh so clever for getting away with smoking pot on the street. Behind the gates in Denmark, you see, marijuana is strictly illegal. And what does the future hold for Christiania? Well, it ain't looking so bright. Just last week, the right-of-center liberal conservative government was re-elected for another term. In their last 4 years of power, they have shown their unwillingness to tolerate the Freetown's existence. Supporters of the party say that Christiania reflects poorly on all of Copenhagen. But those more skeptical of the government's intentions point to the fact that the Freetown also occupies prime real estate in central Copenhagen. We are, however, in Denmark, so don't expect any drastic measures by the government. I predict a steady increase in the restrictions on the Freetown over the next few years. This, of course, will be followed by some good old-fashioned rioting. So will the era of Freetown Christianity eventually come to a complete close? I predict that it will, but not without a proper fight by its residents and all those Danes who are so proud of their live-and-let-live attitude. Thank you for joining me on this walk. You are now entering the EU, says the sign, and just like that, I'm back to Copenhagen, I'm back to Denmark, I'm back to that which I know. For News 101, this is Peter Otis in Copenhagen, Denmark.
And thank you, Peter. You continue to grace us with such interesting content. Okay, to switch things up, our producer Megan Turcato is here now with a look at our oddity of the week. Megan.
Thanks, Rita. The mic is working for me. Today's oddity comes right from our own backyard. A group of suspected drug traffickers in West Vancouver tried to escape detention by calling the police. Yesterday, the police pulled over a vehicle containing three men. When the police approached the vehicle, they noticed a strong smell of marijuana wafting out of the car. While the officers spoke with one suspect outside the car, West Vancouver police received a 911 call reporting a robbery in progress at a local bank. However, the area around the bank was quickly contained, and it was established that no robbery had taken place. The call was later confirmed to have come from a cell phone found on one of the suspects. Their ploy did not work, however, and police continued their investigation, seizing over 11 kilograms of pot from the car. The three suspects were arrested on charges of possession and mischief. What do you have to say about that, Rita, Katie?
That's pretty funny. I think it's actually clever, in theory.
It is. It kind of reminds me, I know I'm bringing a little bit of popular culture here, but Seth Rogen is from West Vancouver, so kind of the antics of Superbad are running through my mind as these kids are, you know, trying to phone the cops to distract them. But I wonder what the people in the bank were thinking when the police surrounded the building.
Right.
I mean, you know, obviously they knew nothing of this, so...
Right, it's pretty unexpected,
are we being robbed?
Yeah. Little did we know.
Maybe it was a silent robbery. They didn't hear the silent alarm. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because I wonder if that's always been one of those boys' tricks up his sleeve, that he always thought, if we ever got pulled over, this is what I'm going to do.
Or maybe it did work in the past, and this time it's just out of luck.
I guess that's the problem with cell phones. They can now track where the call's coming from.
Yeah, technology isn't flawless. There's definitely, there's ways they could
find. Some drawbacks.
Exactly. But no, that's a very interesting story and a local oddity nonetheless. So thank you, Megan, for that. All right, it's break time again, but coming up next, it's the Arts Report with Katie Fitzpatrick. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Menstruation, the final frontier. This is the research of SEMCOR, its continuing mission to explore strange yet familiar body parts, to seek out new information, unfamiliar to the medical profession, to boldly go where no man has gone before. Tired of frantically raising your shields with those unexpected periods? Fed up of not really understanding what's going on in the nether regions of your space? Come to the Center for Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research and learn how to live long and prosper through all phases of your cycle. SEMCOR can give you the tools to chart your way through your cycle so it seems like a safe space rather than the outer reaches of the galaxy. Our prime directive is to educate women about their bodies so they can have peace and a long life. To that end, we're recruiting volunteers for a menstrual cycle and ovulation study involving a personal log and urine samples, all completed in the privacy of your own quarters. Participants must be between the ages of 20 and 40, have menstruated in the last 3 months, and not be taking any hormonal medications such as birth control pills. Resistance is futile. Set your coordinates to www.semcor.ubc.ca or call 604-875-5960. We're the Center for Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Katie Comley alongside Rita Farkas coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Right now it's 5:41 and time to turn things over for the arts. Firstly, we begin with a review from Tracy Fuller.
The UBC Theatre Department's production of Thompson Highway's The Rez Sisters is a powerful, emotional, and seminal piece of theatre. In collaboration with the First Nations House of Learning, director Jonna Wright has brought seven of Canada's most cantankerous, comedic, and iconic theatre characters to life on the stage of the Friedrich Wood Theatre. The seven Aboriginal women, who are related through blood or marriage, combine their efforts and put aside their differences to make it to the world's biggest bingo in Toronto. With dreams of new toilets, new stoves, paved roads, and better lives, they head down Highway 69 to the Silver Dollar Hotel. The women love and hate each other, and through song and comedy, they live their lives as best they can, considering the great limitations of living on the res. The performances of all seven actresses are to be commended, with particular attention going to Kim Harvey, Sarah Affle, and Kate Hilderman. The set and costumes are spectacular, as is the onstage drumming and lighting design. Although the production's colorblind casting has been a cause for controversy, to my mind, the actors and director have obviously poured so much care and attention and respect into this piece that the merits of telling the story supersede the limitations of discretion. The Rez Sisters is a seminal play that has touched audiences across this country and around the world because of the strength of its story and characters. Nothing should stop it from being told. The courage and strength of the UBC production makes it a challenge, but a pleasure to watch. Running at the Friedrich Wood Theatre until November 24th, those who miss out on this production will surely regret it later on. So run to the Rez Sisters. Don't walk. Run. For the arts, I'm Tracy Fuller.
And thank you, Tracy. That sounds like a great production.
It is.
Okay, so we're going to continue with arts. We're going to now take a look at the weekly arts listings with Katie Fitzpatrick.
Hello and welcome to your weekly art spot. I'm Katie Fitzpatrick. Here's what's worth checking out. First of all, there's Bent. Martin Sherman's drama follows a gay man from the decadence of Berlin in the early 1930s to the Dachau concentration camp. That's till November 17th at Performance Works on Cartwright. Tideline. New World Theatre and Touchstone Theatre present Wajdi Muwad's drama about a bicultural North American man's journey to bury his father in his unnamed native land. That's till November 24th at the Randhouse Community Arts and Recreation Centre. Danny and the Deep Blue Sea. Make Our Own Productions presents John Patrick Shanley's play about two troubled souls trying to make sense of their lives. That is till December 18th at the Beaumont Studios on West 5th. In Dance, there's Dance in Vancouver, a showcase of BC's contemporary dance scene featuring performances by Noam Gagnon of the Holy Body Tattoo, One Way Dance, Kokoro Dance, and Kinesis, plus post-show chats, studio presentations, and panel discussions. That is till November 18th at the Scotiabank Dance Centre. There's also the Vancouver Queer Dance Classic. Not So Strictly Ballroom presents a same-sex dance competition with competitors from Vancouver, Washington, Oregon, and California. That is November 17th at the Scottish Cultural Centre. Also, there's Cavalleria Rusticana and Eve Hegliacci. Vancouver Opera presents dramas by Pietro Mascagni and Ruggero Leon Cavallo, performed in Italian with English subtitles. I checked that one out recently. It was pretty interesting. That is November 17th at 8 p.m. at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre. Also in music, there's Hometown Hero. John Kimura Parker performs Brahms. Pianist Parker performs Brahms Piano Concerto No. 1 with the VSO, conducted by Bramwell Tavi. That is tonight at 7 and November 19th at 8 p.m. at the Orpheum Theater. Finally, in literary events, there's Crick Crack. The Vancouver Society of Storytellers presents an evening of sounds and stories of the coast, featuring Dunk Shields and Barry Hall. That is November 18th at 7:30 p.m. at Trinity St. Mark's Church. There's also Thundering Word Heard. Host Bill McNamara welcomes Vancouver's finest poets, musicians, and performers, including singer-songwriter Pharrell Spence. That is at the Montmartre Café, November 18th at 8 p.m. In art galleries, there's a Song of Lilith at the Sydney and Gertrude Zack Gallery. That's works by Lillian Kleiner. There's also Ian Wallace, early works from 1967 to 71 at the Catriona Jeffries Galleries on East First. A Cast of Shadows, Intaglio prints by Jude Grebel, that's at the Burnaby Art Gallery. Mark Lewis, Modern Times, 10 works by the London-based Canadian filmmaker, that's at the Vancouver Art Gallery until January 6th. Finally, one exciting thing to check out this week is the East Side Culture Crawl, an annual three-day visual arts festival. The end involves artists who work on the east side of Vancouver in the areas bounded by Main Street to Commercial Drive and from First Avenue North to the waterfront. You can go check out the exhibits tonight from 5 to 10, tomorrow from 11 to 6, or Sunday from 11 to 6. And also what's pretty exciting is tonight and tomorrow night they're also throwing after parties with live spoken word, film, theater, visual arts, and the like. All right, and next up we have a review of The Rez Sisters by arts volunteer Tracy Fuller.
We apologize for the out-of-order nature of that last segment. Tracy's review was before Katie's listings, but it was a great art segment nonetheless, and thanks to both of them for contributing. And before we go tonight, we're going to check in with our meteorologist, Selena Ferris, for a look at your weekend weather. Selena?
Well, we are stuck between two systems right now, with a big low to the north and the polar jet to the south. This means cold, variable weather as we get the remnants of some shedded fronts moving through. We'll be seeing showers on and off all weekend, with highs around 8 and lows down to 5 degrees. These conditions will persist through till Monday, followed by drier, cooler weather by midweek. So remember your toque and look to the mountains for some snow. And that's your weekend weather, brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com.
Thanks, as always, for that, Selena. That's rather exciting news, weather news. So that's our program for Friday, November 16th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or, of course, you can email us at news@citr.ca.
Megan Turcotto produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Katie Comley.
And I'm Rita Farkas. Thanks for listening. Coming up next, CITR Sports Friday. Tonight, it's Thunderbirds volleyball action as both the men's and women's team take on the visiting Saskatchewan Huskies. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.